Council Malachi, or excuse me, Marshall, if you want to introduce again.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Werke, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning, Council. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This case is our second case on our oral calendar. It is A22-0609, Athena 2004 LLC Respondent versus LC Rochester Inc. et al. Appellants. Council, can I just have you, Mr. Hewell, how do you pronounce your name?
It's Hoyle.
Hoyle? And Mr. Giesen?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Hoyle, I'm not sure your audio is strong enough for us. Can you just say a word or two here? Yeah, this audio is not working. We can't hear you. I mean, it's just very mild. I don't know if you have a headset that you could use or if you can be closer to your microphone or something, but it's not loud enough for us.
Is this the microphone? I mean, is this any good?
That's getting better, yes. So why don't you get yourself set up and keep talking here for a little bit, say the ABCs or something, so we make sure.
I started 7 years ago. Okay,
I think it's a little bit in and out. I don't know if you have a microphone or otherwise you're going to have to be very much focused on your close to the microphone, okay?
You're going to have to put up with my face filling up the entire screen, I guess.
Yeah, so that's
I'll try to raise my voice as well, and we'll try to get through the technical problems.
Good, that sounds a lot better. Good, okay, thank you. Great, okay, and yes, it'll be a pleasure to see your face close up while we can hear you. So, counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes rebuttal if you choose to use it. Each of you, please state your name and the party you represent for the record when you start your principal arguments. We are making an oral audio recording of this Zoom hearing, Zoom oral argument, and that will be available ultimately on our public website. With that, we are ready for counsel for appellant.
John Giesen for LC Rochester.
Go ahead.
Okay. Good morning, Your Honors. We are back before the court. This is the second appeal. After remand, the court made the conclusion that the party's liquidated damages clause in their lease was a penalty. And we're here to ask this court to reverse. The standard of review is de novo. I think the starting point for our penalty argument is the Supreme Court's Gorco construction decision. In particular, the Supreme Court recognized that liquidated damages clauses are prima facie valid. And that's really where we start off from, and it has a lot of logical consequences. Number one, because liquidated damages are not presumed to be invalid, but valid, it's an affirmative defense if a party to a contract that contains a liquidated damages clause wants to seek that clause should not be enforced. And Athena in this case did not plead that there was a penalty here, that this liquidated damages clause was unreasonable. And we raised that at every possible opportunity, and we objected. And the case that
the problem I have, you know, and let me just cut to the heart of this. And I think what the district court was doing, you're talking about liquidated damages. We don't know who really has the burden of proof as far as demonstrating that, but more importantly, how can you demonstrate that you were prejudiced? You know, I look at the entire the very detailed documents that have come in on this case, and I see your clients operating despite the fact that there's not a certificate of another issue, a certificate of completion that's required. I mean, to me, it seems like we're looking at unclean hands. We're looking at a lot of imposition of perhaps some maxims of equity here. So I understand what you're saying, the liquidated damages, you want those to be in your favor, but you certainly knew that's what they were going to be asking. How are you damaged? How are you prejudiced?
Your Honor, I think the process—
besides no money, besides not getting money for it.
So we were supposed to have this building in 2014. We didn't get the building opened for business in 2017. At that point, we never
even had you knew that, and you could have stepped out at any time. You knew that.
That is correct. We knew that, and we entered an addendum to the lease, which said we will waive these liquidated damages, provided that you meet the new deadline. And that was the subject of the last appeal. And this court held, look, the addendum does not apply. The condition precedent, Athena meeting its new deadline, was not met. Therefore, we're back in the lease. So there's been a suggestion by the district court as well as Athena that the delay here is only 2 weeks. That's not true. So the prejudice here is years of delay where we were not able to have a business making profit. And, you know, as
you were, the business was up and running. I mean, the deposition testimony at trial from the city indicates that despite not having that permissive authority, you were operating the business, correct?
I just be careful about which business we're talking about and what time frame. So the 2014 to 2017 time frame, we're not operating the business because the premises weren't provided at that time. After 2017, yes, we are providing are operating the business, and that's undisputed. And you know, we had our testimony about why a certificate of occupancy is central. Essentially, if you don't have a CO, you're subject to zoning enforcement. And in particular, for our client, they were looking to sell the business and weren't able to do that. So I guess, you know, prejudice there, I guess I just want to be clear about what's the prejudice of not bringing a motion, or what's the prejudice of them not finishing the premises on time?
You're arguing that it was detrimental that they did not specifically plead as an affirmative defense the liquidated damages provision.
Correct.
So I'm going to those pleadings, and I'm saying, if you haven't shown prejudice, it could be error, but is it harmless error? And that's one of the questions this court will have when we recess and discuss this case. So that's what I'm focused on.
And here's why the failure to bring a motion to amend was prejudicial and not harmless. And this is what we typically do in a motion to amend context. You argue futility and you argue timeliness. And had Athena brought a motion, as they're required to do under the Supreme Court's Robert's decision, once there's an objection, we would have been making those arguments. And in particular, the futility argument in response to a motion to amend requires the other side to show what evidence they have in order to survive summary judgment. And then we get back to the burden of proof issue. The district court essentially forced us to prove that a prima facie valid liquidated damages clause was actually valid. And that's just, it's total burden shifting. So had the proper process been followed, we could have made these arguments in a much cleaner fashion.
Tell me about the burden. You said burden shifting. Who has the burden? How articulate that for us.
The party asserting that a liquidated damages clause is invalid has the burden to prove that. There's an Eighth Circuit case saying that explicitly, but it follows naturally from that Gorko decision, which says that these things are prima facie valid. What happened here is that we were forced to establish that a presumed valid clause is actually valid, and that's total burden shifting. So had the proper process been followed once we objected to the issue being outside the scope of pleadings, that's the process that would have happened. We could have argued futility and said, what evidence do you have that this is invalid? And why we're here is because the district court forced us to prove actual loss, and that defeats the purpose of having these contract provisions. And I think that's why the Gorko court said these things are presumed valid. They're not frowned upon. You agreed to this, and this isn't just in the lease. This is an addendum 3 years later or 2.5 years later, reaffirming that liquidated damages can be awarded if we don't meet the new deadline.
Wouldn't your client have wanted to prove up actual damages too in the event that liquidated damages were unavailable? So, I mean, wouldn't the evidence of actual damages would have behooved you to put it all in anyway, right? Because you could get actual damages if they weren't liquidated.
Well, I mean, that's an alternative argument. We believe the law
Did you make that argument? Were you arguing in the event that there were no, that liquidated damages were found to be a penalty, that you're entitled to actual damages?
No, we were asserting liquidated damages because we believe that was the exclusive remedy the parties contemplated. So, you know, we get it in a trial brief that despite earlier deposition testimony admitting reasonableness, that they're going to assert this unpleaded defense, we object. And then in the alternative, we do try to preserve the issue that, look, you know, even if it were our burden to prove actual loss, our losses were huge. It's not harmless that we were not able to be open and making profits for at least 2.5 years. It's also not harmless that we were forced to extend a lease at the other store at a significantly detrimental rate. So, you know, we tried to raise it as best we could under the circumstances, given that this wasn't pleaded, but we didn't seek actual loss. And, you know, that really gets to the heart of why you have these provisions. Liquidated damages clauses are supposed to eliminate the need to prove actual loss where it's difficult to do that. And that's, you know, in cases where there's lost profits, delay damages.
Well, but it does require that there be a reasonable forecast of damages. And I'm a little confused by how that would apply in this case. I mean, you've worked in the North pizza business as well as the South pizza business, and the court rejected that. So how can we take that into consideration as far as the reasonable forecast of damages?
You know, we did our best to show the actual loss. And I think the court's finding that our daily profits at the North or the South store, once it finally opened, I think that's, you know, even if it were our burden, we met it. You know, once this North store opened, our daily profits significantly exceeded double daily rent. And that's for the period between September of 2014 and January of 17, when we finally were able to open. So there's some actual loss there. But I think, you know, this all goes back to our burden shifting argument. It shouldn't be our burden to establish why this clause both parties agree to with the help of attorneys is valid and actually an accurate forecast. And, you know, even in Athena's response brief, they're continuing to assert it's our burden to tell the court, you know, why is this valid? That's the totally opposite approach of what should be happening. It should be Athena coming up with evidence saying this is why their damages are non-existent. And, you know, here's the evidence that shows that. And you're not going to hear any evidence that Athena introduced to show that this clause that they agreed to in 2014 and then reaffirmed in late 2016 in the addendum is unreasonable or shouldn't be enforced. There was no evidence put in. It was simply an attempt to force us to prove actual loss. And that's not what the law is on liquidated damages.
What is the law exactly on? Like, what is it that they had to prove in order to establish that they were invalid liquidated damages? What's the standard?
I think there's three main factors that go into it. And this is, again, going back to that Gorko decision. Number one, that the parties could easily ascertain what the damages would be if the project wasn't done on time. And, you know, we established that there's no way to establish or easily see what lost profits are going to be for years of construction delay. So that's the factor number one. Factor number two is the proportionality. And here, I think the critical thing to keep in mind for this court is this is not a 2-week delay. This is a year's delay. So is there a rough proportionality or is it manifestly disproportionate to award years of rent abatement in response to years of construction delay? And the third one is the underlying circumstances. And, you know, this court has held, you know, recently, I think it's 2019, where you have sophisticated parties represented by attorneys entering a contract. You know, both parties were represented when the lease was signed. And then later on, entering another contract after years of delay, reaffirming that liquidated damages are awarded. That's a circumstance that the court has found in the past. Again, I think it's an unpublished 2019 opinion that there's no injustice in holding the parties to what they agreed to, which is essentially our position here is that, you know, apply the rules of procedure, apply what the lease says. And, you know, that's what the law requires.
So that is, I mean, the challenge to me about, I mean, one of the challenges is about this area is that you look at, I think you go back in time to see what the, you know, when they entered the contract to, I don't know exactly when you measure and the validity of the liquidated penalties provision and what the after, how the facts that develop afterwards factor into that. And I was wondering that specifically with respect to the third element that you described as the underlying circumstances. I mean, can one look at the underlying circumstances to include what happened after they entered that contract in 2014 in order to determine like sort of whether it's proportional? I mean, here you had, and I guess the argument, and we'll hear maybe from Mr. Hoyle about that, but, you know, they sort of agreed to continuing it. They, for a couple of years, they weren't really harmed to this extent, et cetera. And so it becomes the underlying circumstances tend to show it's more a penalty given sort of the parties' interactions after the initial lease. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think I understand the question. I think in this case, it's somewhat of a unique situation because you don't have just one clause saying liquidated damages are going to be in play. You've got two contracts. You got the lease and you've got the addendum. So I would think at minimum, you're looking at two different time periods. How about you look at, you know, 2014 when both parties are represented and, you know, say this is going to get done in 3 months and it doesn't happen. And then later in 2016 when they sign the addendum and it's clear that there's a significant liquidated damages at least in play. And they reaffirm that that's going to be back in play if the billing's not done on time. And then look at what they did after they signed the addendum. They kept on the same general contractor despite his failings. And that's undisputed. So, you know, one of the other circumstances the court should consider is that the district court found the delays were entirely Athena's fault and that they didn't do anything to fix the problem. Even after signing the addendum saying that liquidated damages are back in play or are, you know, not that they weren't before, but just reaffirming that. So.
And what is the amount of liquidated damages that your client believes it's entitled to? And what, like, give me the dates and also the numbers.
I think it's September 30th, and I have to go back. I know we've got the exact date in our brief. I think it's September 2014. I forget the exact date, sure. But I think that's in our brief, until the cutoff for the court, which is in November. And that ties into the second argument, which, you know, that's at least until the date we were able to open, but alternatively, if the substantial completion date is incorrect, until the damages cut off, which is in November of 2018. So just
and what's
briefly,
the number for that?
I think it's 3,052 days when we did the math. And I can point.
Okay, that's okay. I'm just wondering if you had a ballpark of the dollars, but okay, that's okay.
Yeah. So I know I'm running out of time here, but essentially we're asking the court to just simply apply the black letter law on how things should be pleaded. And if you want it, an unpleaded issue to be tried over objection, bring a motion. We're also asking the court to reaffirm that the burden to establish invalidity consistent with the Supreme Court's Gorka decision is on the one saying, I don't want to honor this contract. And in consequence of that, we're asking for the court to award liquidated damages and also attorney's fees in light of LC being the only prevailing party. So, thank you.
Thank you. Judge Wheelock, did you have a question?
I do. I just wanted to follow up briefly on your response to Judge Smith's question about when we measure, when do we look at these three elements to evaluate the liquidated damages and whether they were valid or not. You mentioned that under the underlying circumstances, we should also be considering things such as the fact that they entered into an additional agreement, that they didn't switch contractors. Those are all things that happened after you say they breached the contract. So by virtue of that, we would also be looking at things that happened with regard to your client, such as the ability to have the business open and be making sales. Is that accurate?
I think that's accurate. I think this is a catch-all factor. Okay. Is there any injustice here? So I think it's a bit of a loose factor, and I think you should consider the entire record on that factor.
I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And counsel for respondent, Mr. Hoyle.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. And again, if I don't keep my voice up, I hope you raise a finger or something like that. I'll try to make sure that I communicate. I think the first thing, but the only thing I think that we've heard about from the appellants here so far is this talk about the affirmative defense argument. And I'm here to say, as I did in the brief, that the affirmative defense argument is a red herring. It was LC Rochester, it was the appellants in this case, who put the enforceability of the liquidated damages clause in issue. It was pled in their counterclaim that this clause relieved them of the rent obligation that Athena was seeking by way of its complaint. Athena answered the counterclaim. They denied that that was true. So technically, by raising the liquidated damages clause in the first place, the burden was on LC Rochester to prove the liquidated damages clause was reasonable, not Athena.
Now, isn't that just by virtue of the happen? I mean, what if instead the liquidated damages clause, instead of saying it can be used against rent, just said it's X amount of dollars, you know, that the liquidated damages and you know, it happens to match the rent or double the rent. So if rent's $2,000 a month or whatever, the liquidated damages is $4,000 per, you know, however it works out, that it works to be equivalent. Are you saying that the burden is on the party who seeks the liquidated damages to prove they're valid?
No, because as I was just about to then jump in, it says regardless of that, the burden was put on Athena in this case to prove that the liquidated damages clause was a penalty. And Athena satisfied that burden of proof. They cited evidence in the record that proved that the clause was unreasonable. And the district court found that burden was met in this case. When all was said and done, the district court made findings based on the record as a whole. That means evidence received from both sides in this case. And the trial court found as fact that LC Rochester's claim of actual damage directly caused by Athena's breach of the lease amounted to approximately $5,000. Now, the district court went on to compare that loss, the actual loss in that case, to the amount that LC was claiming under the liquidated damages clause, which has already been put to counsel. How much money are you looking for? The trial court went so far as to find that the amount of liquidated damages that was being sought under the trial court's theory of the evidence in this case was $141,000 if the measuring period concluded on December 15th of 2016. But as we've already heard counsel say here as part of the argument this morning, no, that doesn't stop there. It goes all the way till November 18th of 2018. And what they have been arguing in this case is that it continues even to this day and beyond. As LC Rochester's chief manager, Mr. Gommels, testified that they should. Now, this amount of liquidated damages, which are being sought by the appellant in this case, is hugely disproportionate to the actual losses that were sustained as found by the trial court in this case. And that's why the liquidated damages clause is unenforceable. Is there evidence in the record to support that finding by the district court, by Judge Stevens in this case? Well, that's the issue before this court. And if the answer to that question is yes, there is evidence, and my goodness, we have findings of fact that go on for pages and pages and pages that support all of that, then this court should affirm.
I have a question for you, Mr. Hoyle, and you don't get to have a chance to argue on rebuttal. So assuming that we agree that the liquidated damages provision is a penalty, what then does this court do as far as the substantial completion? I mean, obviously, up until the date of the cutoff, you still did not have a certificate of being able to occupy and carry on business. Do we even need to get into that? It impacts attorney's fees, and I can't seem to get those settled in my head.
Okay. Well, I mean, first of all, yes, I think it does impact attorney's fees in that fall. The issue about the substantial completion date, I think, is a fait accompli. That's been done. That's what the first trial.
Oh, we're losing you, and this is important. Get a little closer to the mic because I'm not hearing you.
All right. What I said was that I think that issue is a fait accompli. The first trial decided how much the damages are in the case. The first trial was determinative as to how much the actual damages were proved at the time of that trial. So substantial completion date is no longer an issue here. It's been litigated, that's been tried, that's been appealed, and that's not what's before the court at this point.
So what damages, so this is what I was trying to understand as well, and Judge Working, I'm sorry to step on your toes if I'm doing it here. I'm trying to figure out why substantial completion matters to either party's case and I need some explanation on that. And when you say the first appeal already decided the damages, what damages are you talking about that are already decided in your view? And why does substantial completion matter one way or the other? And if it doesn't matter, why not?
And that, if I may add, that is my very question. And the concern I have is that if in fact the district court erred in determining that there was substantial completion. And we say that that's an error. If there was a remand, we'd have to consider or have the district court consider the provision in your lease for the 50% reduction in rent. So that's a very twisted issue that we need to have unrolled.
Right. But again, the issue before this court, not substantial completion. The issue before this
court. I'm not hearing. I'm sorry, Mr. Hewell. Move her around a little bit and try again.
Sorry too, Judge. I wish I had a better answer. Thank you.
Maybe back up now. I don't know, but we'll give you time here, but it is important to hear you.
Thank you. I mean, is it any better now?
That's good. Okay.
I'm completely off the camera now, but I guess I'm leaning over and talking into a microphone on a laptop. So
Okay.
And we can hear you
really well, though. So right. Let's do that.
I guess that's what's more important. You know, yeah. Nobody's claimed that my face is my fortune. So yeah, we'll leave that alone. In any event, with that interruption, I've got to make sure that I've got the question right again. The issue before this court is not substantial completion. That was an issue that was argued to this court the first time around. What we're talking about now is simply, and the question that I think I'm hearing asking is that how do we measure the period of time to determine whether or not the liquidated damages being claimed is disproportionate to the actual damages that have been found? And that is important to know, when was the substantial completion date done? I think all the parties have assumed that substantial completion has been tried, it has been litigated, it's been appealed. It's been December 15th, 2018, or if I can remember the dates, we're going back so far now. Substantial completion was what was already decided.
And what was decided? Again. Has it been substantially completed?
Yes.
And
yes.
Why? When was it substantially completed?
It was December 15th. And as I say, I think it's 17 now that I'm trying to get my calendar straight in my head. This case is so old. And Judge Stevens reaffirmed that in her findings and in her supplemental findings, talking about the liquidated damages clause. She once again said that substantial completion is December 15th. You may recall by reviewing her findings of fact, that she actually changed the date to January 13th, I think is what it was, in her findings by saying is that, yeah, well, now that I go back here and I find out that all of these dates have become important to be able to determine proportionality, she said, what I should have found in the first instance was that it's actually January 13th of 2017, I think it is.
Right, when they could actually move in and start doing business.
Yeah, well, I mean, she said that would be the date to measure the disproportionality to January 13th, and I guess it's 2017. Those are in her findings. She made that as a finding of fact.
Is it your view then that it is the law of the case that the project was substantially completed in December of 2016?
Yes, yes.
What if we were to disagree? I don't remember. I mean, maybe you argued that in your brief. I don't know. But if we were to disagree and think that is an actual issue on appeal, I mean, that it's not law of the case, let's put it that way. And if we were to decide, no, it was not substantially complete, if we were to address that and to decide it wasn't substantially complete under the meaning of the lease, the definition of the lease, what impact does that have for you?
It makes it even more disproportionate.
Because the penalties continue.
Because that's the Tom Gommel's argument. He's saying is that, no, I'm still getting the benefit of a credit on my rent because I still don't have a permanent certificate of occupancy.
Why do you argue that it was substantial? Why do you care? It seems like what you just told me is, hey, if it's not substantially complete, we're even in better shape. How are you in worse shape? And why do you argue it was substantially complete? That's what I'm having trouble with.
Well, because I'm trying to remain within the confines of the record here. Judge Stevens found that she measured the actual damage period being claimed by LC Rochester in this case by the cutoff date in the original lease, September 2014. And she cut it off originally at December 15th of 2016. And she said that she did the math and said that's $141,000. So if you use that number, just use the number that she found as being the actual damages being claimed in this case, that's hugely disproportionate to the $5,000 in actual damages that she had already determined as a matter of fact in this case.
If I agree with you, Mr. Hoyle, tell me then, why are you entitled, well, you're asking for more attorney's fees. Why are you entitled to any attorney's fees if in fact you're somewhat conceding the, well, I won't say that, but if the substantial completion was not, if we disagree, why would you get attorney's fees? It's kind of a mixed up question. Just tell me why you think you deserve to have attorney's fees.
There's a reversal of attorney's fees clause in the contract, in the lease itself. And what it is dependent upon is whether or not the tenant is in default. The trial court found that the tenant is in default on the lease and has a lease rental obligation of upwards of, at this point in time, some $60,000 in unpaid rent. That's a default that triggers the attorney's fees clause in the lease itself. Judges, I mean.
All right. So, what attorney's fees are you presently awarded?
$10,000.
And what you're saying is that you should have more.
Yes. Now we're into the cross appeal, which of course is the one I really hope that I can talk about there. And I don't think that that's really the.
You got 3 minutes, I guess, to talk about it.
All right. But I mean, really, I would rather keep talking about this question that is being raised here by the appellants, because my point is here, Your Honors, that LC Rochester's been trying to tie these courts into knots with arguments like these affirmative defenses or shifting burdens of proof, striking a brief from the record, temporary versus permanent certificates of occupancy. When what this case is all about is whether or not LC ought to be paying rent for occupying premises, conducting business, and earning a profit off those premises for what is now going on six uninterrupted years, all because they say that they were delayed 16 days in opening for business back in January of 2017. Now,
but if we're back at the initial lease, why are they wrong that no, the delay isn't 16 days, it's 2 years, or it's whatever, you know, you do the math, 2 years plus.
Well, I mean, it's all well and good that LC Rochester insists that the delay is to be measured in years, not days. But the facts are, and the facts has been found in this case by the fact finder, and that LC Rochester sustained no damage, no loss during that 2 year period while they were waiting for this South store to be built and to be opened up. The facts in this case are, is that LC Rochester paid no rent to Athena during that period of time. They invested no money in the building that was being constructed for their occupancy. They had no part in settling the cross parking easement dispute that caused the delay in the first place. Rather, what LC did in this case is they simply stood by idly. They kept their existing store, what they call the North Store, they kept it open and generating revenue and simply waited out the delay. Your Honors, this case was fairly tried. LC Rochester was never deprived of any opportunity to litigate or argue any of the issues in this case, which they have now taken into this Court of Appeals for the second time. The district court did not fail to apply the law as it exists to the facts that it found. Would the amount of liquidated damages as claimed by LC Rochester be reasonably equal to its actual damages? And did the lease agreement say how much those actual damages were going to be? No, it did not. The answer to those questions is no. Was the clause intended as a penalty rather than a reasonable forecast of actual damage? That's what Mr. Gommels testified to at the trial. And I cited this testimony in the brief. In the trial transcript at page 79, what Mr. Gommels said, what we were going to introduce was penalties for the project not being done. On the basis of that, we respectfully request you affirm us to this issue, but reverse.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. I don't see any other questions. And Mr. Giesen, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I heard Mr. Hoyle state that, you know, this is, I don't know if he said angels dancing on the head of a pin, burden of proof and affirmative defenses. It's not true. This is, you know, we're just simply asking for basic principles of law, including the burden of proof to be enforced by this court.
Tell me about your award of attorney's fees and why you feel that that you were not properly awarded by the court. What award do you have now, and what do you why is that not appropriate?
Right now, we have a small award. Essentially, the district court was reversed by this court previously. And made additional findings that despite the years of delay.
Is that the $1,200 attorney's fees
cost? I don't have the exact amount, but it's a nominal amount. And instead of readdressing attorney's fees in light of the lease applying rather than the addendum, the district court said, well, it's essentially the same thing as before. So I'm just going to reapply the same attorney's fee award as I did before. Obviously, we think we're the sole prevailing party in this. We don't feel like we should be the one paying attorney's fees where the other party has breached the contract and produced the building years late. So, you know, we set that out in our brief, but essentially we should be the only prevailing party in this. Again, you have not heard any evidence produced by Athena to satisfy its burden of proof, and that should be the end of the question. The fundamental error here of the district court is to blame us for not producing evidence of actual loss, even though we did, and the district court simply discredited that, and as Mr. Hoyle said, found it speculative. That's irrelevant. It should be Athena's evidence establishing its affirmative defense. And that's well, not...
You've argued that there... you spent a lot of time on this Mensis deletion, but it appeared to me that the district court threaded all of that information that you felt you were not credited with in the final opinion.
Well...
Is that just a procedural thing that you're arguing about? I don't know if that it has any impact.
Last appeal, we had a scope of review debate about whether we made arguments or not. And, you know, it was deeply concerning to us that the district court deleted an argument where we clearly re-raised the same objections we've always made in this case, and then appeared to make an adverse scope of review. And I don't think it's particularly relevant if there's no concerns that we've preserved this issue, and I believe we have. But it's just additional evidence. Look, we've raised these same issues, including the burden of proof, including the procedural error about, you know, forcing us to respond to a unpleaded affirmative defense that was never a subject of a motion to amend. We've been making these same arguments from the beginning, and that's the only reason we bring that issue up.
Can you speak to the substantial completion issue and how it affects both claims, the claims or defenses in this case, please?
First, I want to address the law of the case. We did address that in our reply brief. So if you want to see our analysis on that, number one, it's not law of the case. There was a new finding made after remand. You can't challenge a new finding in an old appeal. I mean, that's just not possible. And we can't be, you know, held to that, you know, have challenged a new finding previously. It matters for the liquidated damages calculation because you get 2 days of rent abatement for each day of delay as measured by substantial completion. And you know, argument on substantial completion is look at what the record before the court is. You know, Mr. Hoyle is going out to even today and all this thing. You know, we're making a argument based on the facts presented to the district court, and that district court had the cutoff of 2018. If this district court were hearing the same case today and there was a new damages period, we may be making a very different argument. But we feel like we were, you know, crushed on the North Shore lease. We're not able to make profits from a store for a several year period. And we've had no evidence introduced showing that this was somehow benign, that, you know, years late, just we stood by idly. That's not the evidence in the record. The evidence in the record is that we were consistently being, you know, when is this building going to get done? And we were strung along by a contractor who wouldn't even answer the phone. So, you know, I have to respectfully disagree with the characterizations by Mr. Hoyle in that regard.
So just to be clear then, if for example, and I, we were to conclude that the district, if we were to affirm the district court's determination that the liquidated damages provision is a invalid penalty, if we were to do that, does substantial completion matter to you anymore?
I think it still does. I think you can look at the court's amended findings where she found that the substantial completion date was wrong, and then that would have impact, and then just didn't do anything with that. I think even for the rent owed, that has.
So do we need to determine, what you're saying is we need to determine the substantial completion date in order to review the determination about the validity of the liquidated damages provision?
I think that is a factor. I mean, one of the issues is proportionality and what are the liquidated damages we're claiming in comparison to the period of delay. And I think it's also relevant, you know, for the actual claim of the plaintiff in this case, is to come off of rent they're owed. So I see I'm out of time. Okay. I appreciate the panel's attention.
Thank you both.
Don't further questions.
Don't leave though, Mr. Giesen. And we have a technical issue here.
So I saw that.
Yes. Okay.
I'm hoping I can help. I need to transfer hosting. I guess I'm now the host of the Court of Appeals, huh? I'm just reading the message now, and I'm going to try to figure this out.
Okay.
But thank you for your consideration.
Yes, thank you both. The case is submitted. You can hang on, everyone, just till we get this figured out. We'll have a decision out in the statutory time period, and I do appreciate your arguments.